All right. My name is Nathan Myers. I'm an associate professor in the political science department at Indiana State University. And I'm here with Dr. Eric Toner, who is a senior scholar with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and a senior scientist in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, Department of Environmental Health and Engineering. And Dr. Toner has published numerous scholarly papers and government reports on healthcare and pandemic preparedness, as well as having substantial experience in the field dealing with healthcare preparedness issues. So I appreciate Dr. Toner taking the time to speak with me today. And in particular, I wanted to talk about the upcoming CLADE-X exercise that the Center for Health Security is going to be putting on May 15th, and that exercise will be made available through Facebook Live, I believe, so that other people outside of those who are actually at the center will be able to see the exercise taking place. So Dr. Toner, again, thank you. And my first question is, what is the mission of the exercise? What do you hope that the exercise will accomplish?
Well, Nathan, thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak to you. The purpose of CLADE-X is to raise awareness both among the political leaders and subject matter experts in emerging infectious diseases and healthcare preparedness, but also among the broader audience of the general public and people who might be interested in this topic.
And how has the exercise been shaped by the results and findings from previous exercises? I know there was, you know, the dark winter exercise and the Atlantic storm exercise previous to this. So have they influenced this exercise in any way?
Yes, very much so. So the dark winter exercise, which was held in the spring of 2001, focused on the potential terrorist use of smallpox as a biological weapon. And although that didn't have immediate public visibility, it greatly influenced national policy, in part because it was followed shortly thereafter by the 9/11 terrorist attacks and the anthrax letters. So that really did shape U.S. policy in many ways. So that was an exercise in which we had prominent political figures playing roles of the U.S. president and other U.S. national leaders. So in that exercise, Sam Nunn played the role of the U.S. president. Atlantic Storm, which was held in 2005, again focused on smallpox, but this time it focused on the bioterrorist use of smallpox internationally. So it was a group of international leaders, NATO countries, that had come together for a summit. And during the summit, there were multiple releases of smallpox. And so the discussion focused on the transatlantic response, how countries would cooperate, potentially share vaccine and other resources. And in that exercise, we had former government officials from a number of NATO countries. And in that exercise, Madeleine Albright played the role of the U.S. president. That was a much more publicly visible exercise. It was broadcast on both Nightline and on the BBC. And although that didn't as directly affect U.S. national policy, it raised a lot of awareness around the issue of and the threat of bioterrorism. So what we're trying to do in this exercise is replicate some of the production values of particularly Atlantic Storm, and which turned out to be pretty compelling television. And so we're trying to replicate that, but focus rather on specifically on bioterrorism and specifically on smallpox, on the threat of pandemic. And so we hope to touch on many of the issues that came up in our previous exercises and other exercises that we and others have done. There remain still compelling issues that haven't been resolved. And we want to bring attention to those issues and try and propose ways through the exercise that they could be solved.
All right, thank you. So I looked through some of the reports that were issued after the two exercises, the Atlantic Storm and the Dark Winter exercises. And I just kind of wanted to ask you your thoughts on some of these issues and their relevance today, and if they'll play a part in the Clay X exercise coming up. So one thing that came out of previous exercises has been the difficulty in resolving scientific disputes between countries and the importance of having procedures in place for deciding on how to resolve those issues in the future. Have you seen much progress in this regard over the course of the last decade? And will this play any kind of a role in the Clade X exercise you have coming up?
It remains a problem. and I'm not sure that there's been tremendous progress in that area. And to some extent, it will play a part in Clade X. Maybe not as much of a role, but sort of scientific uncertainty is always an issue. And in the way in which political leaders deal with scientific uncertainty is always an interesting topic. And to some extent, that will be part of this exercise. That it will show up in the narrative, and I think in the discussions that the players have.
So, based on recent experiences with Ebola and Zika, should the American public expect either leaders in the U.S. or world leaders to really take into account the recommendation of experts when it comes to public health emergencies? Have you seen more attention being placed on the recommendations of experts and information provided by experts over the last decade or so as compared to when those previous exercises took place?
Well, I think we'll see in the exercise whether they do or not. I think in general, there's always a tension between science and politics, and politicians always have an ear to what is politically expedient or politically possible. I think as a rule, politicians and elected leaders, most of them believe in science. They don't think they always understand science, but they believe in what they're told. But when it is in contrast to what's the political realities of their, or at least their perceived political realities of their situation, I think often they temper what they're being told by scientists, and they do what they feel able to do. And we should not put all politicians and elected leaders in the same bucket. Obviously, there's a wide spectrum, and some are more influenced by science than others. But I think as a rule, most politicians are greatly bothered by scientific uncertainty. And scientists have a great deal of trouble talking about science without prominently mentioning the uncertainty that exists. And I think that leaves politicians in an awkward place because they don't really feel very comfortable dealing with uncertainty. They would much rather be told what is or what isn't, and scientists have difficulty doing that.
Yeah, so the U.S. has taken some steps recently to try to improve its capacity to respond to biothreats. They're working on the reauthorization of the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act in Congress right now, and CMS issued a hospital preparedness rule back in 2016, which became sort of operational in November of 2017. To what degree are these efforts, in your view, adequate to sort of propel the cultural change needed to get hospitals and public health departments and other entities to make biothreats a priority in the United States?
Well, I think they are incremental steps. I think they are useful, but they are not by themselves sufficient. So I think the reauthorization of the of PAHPA, the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act, mostly continues efforts that have been ongoing now for the last 10 years and makes some improvements, which generally I favor. I think the CMS preparedness rule that came out last year also is a good but incremental step forward. It requires all healthcare facilities and providers that receive money under Medicare and Medicaid to meet some pretty basic preparedness goals. It's not clear how much that will be enforced, and there's no financial incentive tied to it, and very little in the way of probably realistic penalty related to it. But it is something that is good and took a long time to get through. So it's a step forward. I think there's a lot of evidence that the U.S. is better prepared now for all kinds of relatively small disasters. We see this almost every day, certainly every week. There are tornadoes and small earthquakes and bus crashes and unfortunately many shootings and things like that that are handled relatively well by local officials and the health systems that exist in their communities. It is less clear how well prepared we are for larger scale events. In part, it's because we don't have, because they happen infrequently, it's harder to make broad generalizations about how well they've been handled. And certainly we have not had an opportunity, fortunately, to find out how well prepared we are for large-scale biological events. The only one we had in this country was the 2009 influenza pandemic, which was quite mild. And I would sort of grade our response as being, a C, maybe a B minus. But it was probably better than it would have been in the past. So I would say that we've seen general progress in our preparedness. I think that if we look at the larger end of the severity spectrum, I still have a lot of concerns about our ability to respond to fairly catastrophic events.
So kind of changing focus a little bit from the more domestic to the international, one of the recommendations that came out of the Atlantic Storm exercise was that an international organization and the World Health Organization was specifically identified during that exercise should serve as an honest broker in an international situation to sort of resolve disputes about vaccine sharing and things like that. However, the organization, the WHO, has taken some criticism of late for its handling of Ebola and other issues. So in your view, is it still feasible for the WHO to serve that kind of honest broker function? And if not, is there another sort of international entity that could sort of step in and do that?
Well, I agree with your assessment that WHO, didn't shine during Ebola, and the weaknesses inherent in the way the WHO is organized and functions became apparent. I do think that WHO is the only entity that exists that could possibly play this this role. But WHO has to change the way it operates, and whether it can do that or not, I think, is unclear. But I don't see another alternative right now. And the extent to which vaccines or medicines are shared in a pandemic, it's really unclear, and whether WHO can do that or not is equally unclear.
One of the themes that they came across in both the previous exercises, and I imagine this will be true of the Clade X exercise as well, is the importance of effective communication during an emergency, both communication between the sort of entities responsible for responding to events, and also communication from the government to the public to convey accurate information about what's going on and what the public should do. And now, what's different, from today, compared to when those previous exercises were done, is the prevalence of social media, which has both the potential to really facilitate communication, but it can also, unfortunately, facilitate information that is not true or is inaccurate. So from your perspective, when it comes to a situation like the kind of situation that Clade X will be looking at, do you see social media as being more of a tool that will help in those kinds of situations, or something that could actually hinder the response by spreading inaccurate information?
Well, just as you said, I think social media is a double-edged sword. And it certainly is a useful tool for relaying information, and it is how most people get their news these days. I would add, unfortunately, but it is the case. But it's equally the case that there's tremendous amount of misinformation on social media. We have tried to build social media into the Clade X scenario, and so those people who watch it, either live stream it or watch it on Facebook later, will see some of that played out in the exercise. And how the participants deal with this information is going to be interesting to see. We thought at one point of trying to include a live Twitter feed during the exercise, but it became technically too challenging. So, but it is absolutely the case that for better or worse, social media is central to communications these days.
So kind of going back to the theme of public trust, I asked the question earlier about leaders sort of taking the recommendations of experts. Looking at the sort of the trust that the American public in general hold toward their elected leaders, there's some evidence based on polling that public trust in elected officials has gone down over the last few years, that, you know, trust in Congress and the executive branch is not all that strong. In the event of a virulent pandemic or a bioterror attack, what percentage of the U.S. population would you estimate would be willing to follow government recommendations, especially if they, you know, involve sort of, you know, mass vaccination or quarantine, something that would be a little bit more outside the realm of what we've experienced in the past?
Well, I think it is true. I think it's observable that the public has relatively little trust in politicians. But I do think the majority of Americans still believe in science and still believe in what subject matter experts, you know, doctors and scientists have to say. There is obviously a vocal minority, and it's quite small, that opposes science, and we will have to face that in any crisis. But I think the majority of Americans will believe that, you know, recommended vaccines are, you know, in their interests. And I think we've seen in previous epidemics that when there's nothing going on, people tend to be afraid or leery of medicines and vaccines. But when they see people around them dying, they suddenly become much more amenable to those kinds of interventions. So I suspect in a real crisis, there'll be a lot of interest and clamoring for a vaccine if it appears to be effective.
Going along that same idea of the importance of vaccines, what are the major gaps you see in regard to the development of medical countermeasures and our ability to effectively distribute those medical countermeasures in the event of a major emergency?
Well, you know, this is a critically important issue, and every step along the way, from basic research to distribution dispensing, takes much too long. You know, of all the disease outbreaks that have occurred in the last couple decades now, SARS, MERS, even HIV, Zika, Ebola, West Nile, we don't have vaccines for any of those diseases, licensed vaccines, that is. So it's not because we haven't researched them, it's because it takes tremendous amounts of time. It also, there are aspects of the marketplace that play into this, you know, whether or not a pharmaceutical company wants to devote billions of dollars into developing a vaccine that may or may not have much of a, you know, customer base. So there are many problems all along the spectrum of vaccine development, but it is the one thing that has the potential to change the game in a large outbreak of a severe illness.
And what about sort of putting aside the vaccine issue, what about our sort of ability to engage in surveillance and sort of track information in real time to identify when outbreaks are occurring? Have we seen any kind of appreciable improvements in our monitoring and reporting ability over the last decade or so?
Yes, I think we've seen substantial improvement, particularly with regards to identifying unknown pathogens. So a newly discovered disease with an unknown pathogen, we are likely to be able to figure out what that pathogen is really quite quickly, in a matter of days or weeks. And once we've figured that out, and are able to test for it, and being able to come up with rapid or come up with tests more rapidly is also an area in which we've made substantial progress. We can then try to surveil and monitor the spread of the disease. And we've seen substantial improvement in that realm as well, both in the US and across the world. It is part of the international health regulations that nearly all countries have signed on to. Now, not all countries are fully compliant with those regulations, and there are many gaps, particularly in under-resourced countries, but it's getting better. So I am confident that if a novel disease appeared, we would know about it pretty quickly. We would certainly know about it within days, I would think, or maybe weeks if it's in a remote area, through online boards like ProMed, where people report apparent disease outbreaks. So I think we know about it pretty quickly. I think we'd identify what it is pretty quickly. I think we'd be able to monitor the spread of it. Certainly, that went pretty well with the various forms of avian influenza in the last 10 years or so. So for H5N1 and for H7N9 and other avian flu variants, we've been able to track cases of that pretty well. So I think that's one area in which we've seen significant progress. It could be better, and I think over time it will get better. But we know when these diseases arise, I'd be much happier if we were able to do something about it.
So another issue that's been seen in previous exercises is the problem of surge capacity in the U.S. healthcare system and really healthcare systems around the world. And we've seen kind of firsthand with the recent flu season that really put a lot of stress on hospitals and the overall healthcare system. So what actions, in your view, does the U.S. need to do to address the issue of surge capacity, and does this play a role in the upcoming CLADEX exercise?
It does play some role in CLADEX. It's absolutely true that in any large disaster or disease outbreak, surge capacity will be a major problem. The hospitals in the United States and elsewhere around the world, this is pretty much universally true, are finely tuned with regards to capacity to, you know, the level of care that they normally provide. So hospitals are right-sized to their average census plus a little bit more. And it's not economically advantageous to hospitals to have a lot of excess capacity. So what we have proposed and others have proposed is that the focus on the preparedness focus should be on building of coalitions among healthcare facilities in partnership with public health and emergency management agencies. So even though there may be limited surge capacity in an individual hospital, there will be more surge capacity in a coalition of hospitals. And so thinking of surge capacity as being primarily an issue for communities or jurisdictions rather than individual hospitals, we think is the right way to go.
So part of I think you said earlier on that, you know, part of the mission of the CLADEX exercise is to sort of raise awareness among U.S. leaders and among the public that, you know, biological threats, whether man-made or natural, are still very much a threat today. Do you think that overall U.S. and world leaders are more knowledgeable about biological threats today than they were when they did Atlantic Storm and Dark Winter, about a decade or so ago?
Unfortunately, I don't think that's the case. I think, particularly with Atlantic Storm, which occurred just a few years, a couple of years after the anthrax attacks, and occurred right around the time that we were, it occurred roughly 2 years after SARS, and just as H5N1 influenza was beginning to be a great concern. So at that time, I think there was a lot more awareness, a lot more concern about biological threats. I think over time that has waned. And I think the fact that we had a fairly mild flu pandemic in 2009, that although the Ebola outbreak in West Africa was terrible for West Africa, it didn't cause tremendous problems for the United States, that Zika has largely fizzled. I think people are taking the message from those events that the biohazard is less than some have said. It's absolutely not the case. The risk of biology, the threat of biohazard is much greater than it has been in the past. But I don't think that's widely recognized.
And my final question, or I guess it's kind of a question and then a follow-up question. The first is, how has the ClADEX exercise been designed to reflect 21st century realities? So, the previous exercises, took place early on in the 21st century. But as things have developed since then, how has the exercise been updated to kind of, represent some modern or current challenges that we're facing?
So without going into details of the exercise, which would be a spoiler for people who want to watch the event, we certainly take into consideration modern technology, including social media, but also advances in biotechnology and what they offer. And we take into consideration the state of the U.S. healthcare system as it exists now. And there are other ways in which we've modernized this, but I won't spoil the fun by divulging them right now.
Okay. And the sort of second part of that question is, in what ways do you think the exercise will help to move preparedness efforts forward as we continue to confront these different challenges over time?
Well, if we're successful with this exercise, it will hopefully widen people's eyes, and we will engage them viscerally in the kinds of threats that biology and biotechnology and emerging infectious diseases pose to the human population. And, we hope that it'll raise awareness. We will make recommendations on areas in which we think policy could make a difference. There have been policy recommendations for a couple decades now that haven't been resolved, largely because of lack of sufficient political will. And so we will highlight these and make recommendations that we think could make a difference.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today. Dr. Eric Toner from the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. And again, the ClADEX exercise will take place on May 15th. Do you want to give some more specific information in terms of start time and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, so it will start at 9 a.m. on May 15th. It can be accessed through the Center for Health Security's website. And I should know this, it's www.healthsecurity.org, I believe. I should probably check that as I'm saying it.
I think it's centerforhealthsecurity.org. That's what I have on a paper here anyway.
It's centerforhealthsecurity.org, all one word, centerforhealthsecurity, all one word, .org. And there will be a prominent link to the event there, and you should be able to watch it on through our webpage on Facebook.
All right. Well, I will be watching, and I'll be very interested to see how things play out. And I wish you the best of luck with the exercise. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it.